everybody. Welcome to the kitchen table today. It's so nice to have all of you here. We appreciate you joining us on this wonderful, wonderful morning. I know everybody's out there. Michelle, it's only 10 days to Christmas. So,
you got my gift?
I'm looking.
Do you need a list?
That would be very helpful. In fact, I walked down to one of my favorite stores yesterday in the French Quarter of New Orleans. You know Lucullus.
Of course I do.
I walked into Lucullus.
Put your name on a couple of things.
I was so compulsive, I couldn't register. I just bought it. So anyway, so nice to have all of you here. Not even a couple of weeks away from Christmas, and we hope that you've made your list and checked it twice, and I hope that you're thinking long and hard about the dishes you're going to cook for family and friends coming over for the holidays. And I'll begin today by welcoming Michelle York, our executive producer. You doing all right?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for asking.
And across the glass wall over there, our engineer keeping us alive and well across that big old satellite, taking us across the world today, and that is Dean Slama. What's going on, Slama?
Oh, not too much. Thanks for asking, John.
Well, you know, 10 days to Christmas.
Huh? Yeah, and you can feel it. Louisiana's finally chilling out.
Also, it's the Christmas tree that's throwing everything off. It's beautiful in here, huh? I want to tell the two of you, and I'll just chastise you on the air. I don't appreciate decorating alone.
Is that right?
That's right. I had to decorate alone, but I did the best I could. But I tell you what, it rivaled Rockefeller Center.
I was thinking that myself.
Anyway, y'all, it is beginning to look a lot like Christmas, and I don't know whether you call it a chill in the air or you just call it a seasonal change, you know, because in Louisiana, a chill could be 70 degrees, you know, from a night out. But anyway, it is that time of year, and I know it especially because holiday gifts from friends and family around the world start to kind of roll in and appear on the desk. The UPS guy will walk in. I've already received a beautiful, beautiful country ham.
Yeah, what are you going to do with that?
I think I'm going to talk to Nathan today when he comes in. You know, he's going to be our guest on the show today. And I got this beautiful ham from Wynn Radford. I want to talk a little bit about country ham today with our guest when he comes in. I got a beautiful box of jams and jellies from this guy, Michael Sully, we call him Sully Sullivan from Black Bear Farm. He's the butcher over there. And wow, what a great charcuterie he is. You know, I mean, he does great, great work. And I got all kind of good pâtés and some little jams and jellies and some stuff from him.
I didn't see that box.
Oh, yeah. Somebody opened it before I got to it. And
you have any of those pâtés left?
Yeah, I got some in there. I think they're still in there. There's biscuit mixes in there. There's jams and jellies. There's some great stuff in there. My favorite so far, though, I got a little box from the West Coast. You know, a selection of talking about pâtés, and there's a country pâté in there. There was a little foie gras mousse, a little duck mousse in there. And you know how I love those pâtés and terrines.
Oh, me too. In fact, remember a couple of years ago, you took a group of us to France?
I like Slama. You didn't pick this up, but she said, what she started to say was, I remember a couple of years ago when you took a couple of them. She went
went
way down low on the fact that I paid for that trip.
I have mentioned this many times, your generosity of taking a group of us to France, and our friend Mary Martin was with us.
She was our life of the party.
She was. Oh, I love Mary Martin. And she said that. She said, y'all have never met a pâté that you didn't like. And she was right. I think you and I ate our way in pâté.
Oh, absolutely. And I went to this little, I think y'all had left.
Here we go. You heard that part, Slama? Rest of you left and I stayed. Go ahead with the story.
Then I went to work.
We digress.
I was a judge for the Bocuse d'Or, the greatest culinary competition in the world with Paul Bocuse. I was the American judge. And all the fun and games had been done by that time. We had obliterated Paris with our credit cards. We had taken a trip from Paris to Lyon, the bus, and stopped at all these beautiful little medieval villages and wine shops and you name it. Then it was time to work. The minute I said work, everybody got the bus and came back to America. And I stayed for 3 days and worked. Anyway, y'all, talking about pâtés, they are delicious, though, and they are absolutely memorable dishes at holiday parties. And, you know, really easy and inexpensive to make if you just want to begin at the beginning. But to talk about pâtés, we really have to begin with the boucherie. And, of course, it's boucherie season in Louisiana now. The minute it gets nice and cold, it's time to slaughter the pig. It's time to clean and dress the hogs and make a plethora of all of those wonderful, wonderful holiday dishes that sustained the community many years ago and eventually made their way out, obviously, to the holiday table. That's where, you know, charcuterie enters the picture. And charcuterie is derived from the French word chard, which means flesh. Bavillon means meat, but when you get to flesh, it's shod. And cuit, which means to cook flesh. So charcuterie is obviously a cooking art all in itself. Very interesting when you start to talk to people about boucheries and charcuteries and what you make out of it.
And I guess a lot of the Cajun French in Louisiana may associate charcuterie, as you're talking about, with dried or smoked sausages, right?
Right, exactly.
The andouille and maybe even the Italian soppressata?
Sure, soppressata is part of charcuterie.
But you know, charcuterie actually has its early roots in Roman Greece. They did a lot of preparing and preserving meats with salts and fats and spices. And then, of course, you know, in the 15th century, the food guilds came along in Europe. Many of the guilds were charged with maintaining the food supply for the community, which was a pretty vital role at that time. But by the time of the French Revolution, there were about 100 master charcutiers in the capital of France.
Last night in the restaurant, talking about early French Revolution, this guy, Michael Martello, walked into the restaurant, and he was the bailli, the head of the chaîne de rôtisserie from the West Coast. And his home was in Carmel, California.
Okay.
And he came in, and we got to talking about it. He said he absolutely loved the charcuterie board that we put on his table. I told him we'd be doing a show on charcuterie today, and he says, oh, my God, I have to get a copy of it. He said, I've been dabbling in it. So the world is dabbling in charcuterie today. And even the chaîne de rôtisserie, when you talk about master charcutiers or you talk about master arts and crafts, even the chaîne de rôtisserie that was founded back in the 1700s, again, was about taking these things from the boucherie or from the charcuterie shops and putting it on grand tables to create masterful buffets. And that's what fine eating was all about at that time as well. And as you mentioned, Michelle, with the French Revolution, nearly 100 master charcutiers in the capital of France. And so began the great world of pâtés and terrines and galantines. Pâté generally refers to an elegant, well-seasoned ground meat preparation that can either be satiny smooth if you run it through a tammy or you run it through some type of a screen mold of some type. It can be spreadable or it can be coarse, like a country pâté, a mixture of meats of any kind, like pork and veal and liver and ham and fish, poultry, game. All can be ground, and then with fat added becomes these items. So, I mean, when you think of the pâtés and terrines that you were eating in France, you probably experienced some of all of those.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, at this time of year, as you were saying, the pâtés kind of come out, or you see more of them because of all the holiday parties. And I love making that chicken liver pâté. Of course, I'm a chicken liver freak anyway, but you have a great, great recipe for chicken liver pâté.
And I think people can tend to be a little afraid to walk up to things that they don't recognize on the table, no matter how beautifully presented they are. And there's these stigmas of these organ meats that just absolutely drive me up a wall when somebody says, oh, I don't eat chicken liver. I hate chicken liver. I hate chicken liver. I said, oh, my God, really? Do you hate it, or you've just never had it prepared in a way that's really sought after globally that people want to taste? And this chicken liver pâté that I make, where I roast the chicken livers first in herbs and spices and then flame it in French brandy and then puree the whole thing with heavy whipping cream and then mold it back in.
And even a little sweetness in
there. I mean, it's just absolutely magnificent. It's smooth, it's creamy, it's wonderful. Well, I think many folks don't realize that there's all sort of vegetable pâtés, like my roasted onion and eggplant pâté. Now, if you tell them onion and eggplant, oh, I'll try that. I mean, it's a vegetable dish, you know. But there's great, great vegetable pâtés now, asparagus terrines and carrot and all those beautiful vivid colors in a vegetable terrine. Mm-hmm. All the fish terrines are just so fantastic. And all of them can be served, you know, center of the plate, or they can be served as spreads, or they can be served as dips, or they can be served with a nice crusty piece of bread that you would smooth something out on.
But what about the pâtés that I see kind of encased in pastry? Because that's a pâté as well, isn't it? Pâté. They look like edible art.
Well, they are edible art. And, I mean, that was the whole purpose, to encase these pâtés or terrines in pie crust. And whenever you see a terrine put inside of a pie crust, then it's called pâté en croûte. It's in crust or in pie. For extra flavor and to preserve a terrine, often you're going to see that quarter-inch thick layer of aspic that's put on the top. Sometimes the aspic is flavored. Sometimes it's just savory. Sometimes there's even herbs and spices mixed amongst the aspic that goes on top. Or vegetable stock that gelatin is added to that creates a really wonderful topping as well. And one of my favorite terrines of all is the fromage de tête de cochon, which is the hogshead cheese, which I love. And, of course, it's lovingly known by all of us as head cheese, you know. And here's an example of using all of the parts of the pig's heads, the vegetables, the parsley, all cooked in a pork stock. It can be chunky. It can be country style. It can be spreadable, too, like a pate. And I like to add some Boston butt and always pig feet. I like a meaty fromage de tête de cochon. So I'll put a pork shoulder in it. And then, of course, you know me, a lot of garlic. And then, of course, it can be served. I had a guest in the restaurant last night who said, I always take my hogshead cheese and just cut a nice slice and serve it elegantly in the center of a beautiful plate. She said, I'll use Limoges often. And I don't want bread or crackers. I eat it with a knife and a fork. Miss Tremaine.
Oh, I could see her doing that, too.
Oh, my God. She says, when I was singing in New York, she said, I would have them send my dope glacé to me overnight packed in ice. How they ever got it there, I don't know. She was really fantastic last night. Well, y'all, we're talking about the whole hog today, to everything from fresh sausages for the table to the mouth-watering, magnificent pâtés and terrines that's going to wow your guests. And we have to take a quick break right now, but when we come back, we're going to be talking about the art of boucherie and charcuterie.
You can give me pig meat. I mean, you can give me pig meat. Pig meat is what I crave. When I die, you need to bury me at all. Hang me up against the pig meat's wall. And you can give me pig meat. You can give me pig meat. I mean, you can give me pig meat. Pig meat is what I crave. It will be seen that little love of a pig meat.
Daddy Cecil here. For 2 hours of word sound power, Rasta Reggae Radio, it's Jamon. Jamon, Sunday nights, 9 to 11 p.m. Rebroadcast Saturday mornings, 1 to 3 a.m. here on KRVS.
If there's a car, truck, or boat taking up space at your house, and you're finally ready to do something about it, KRVS just might be the answer. Your vehicle could be used to support public radio in our community through KRVS's car donation program. One phone call is all it takes. Whether it's running or not, we'll come and get the vehicle, send you a tax receipt when it sells, and you just supported KRVS. Call us now at 877-KRVS-887 or visit our website at krvs.org to learn more. And thanks.
Welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio, the best cultural show on radio as well, because we're always bringing to the surface those sought-after traditions and those little pieces of history that can be or may be forgotten if it wouldn't be for us right here on Stirring It Up, I think. What you think?
We're preserving history.
We're preserving history whether we like it or not, Salama, right here. And, of course, we always have a great guest with us on the show today. And today we're talking about charcuterie. We're talking about the art of not only preserving but presenting beautiful cuts of meats in wonderful ways. And I think a process that confuses a lot of folks when, in reality, it was just a way of the kitchen many years ago, and everybody was into charcuterie because it was about preservation. Michelle, introduce our guest.
We have a good Cajun boy with us today from down the bayou. Nathan Richard. He grew up helping his dad cook, like so many great chefs, kind of learning at the apron strings of those who cook in the kitchen that we love. He was active with his papa, I'm assuming that's grandfather,
yes,
picking vegetables from the garden. And, you know, ironically enough, Nathan actually studied to be an EMT and studied fire science. Now, somehow I think that that's probably pretty appropriate now. He wanted to be an arson investigator, and now he's all about charcuterie and fire and preserving, so I'm sure that comes in handy. He did make that change when he was just 22, and he started as a prep cook in the kitchens at Commander's Palace. Now, that's a pretty good place to start, I gotta say, just to kind of jump in there, work your way through the ranks, pastry chef, sous chef, butcher. He went to Delgado Community College. He also had an opportunity to travel, and John, you and I just love that so much. You learn so much when you travel. He went to the U.S. and British Virgin Islands. He was in Europe for a while. He worked with some of the best butchers in the world in Europe. He went on to Charleston, where he worked as sous chef and butcher under James Beard, award-winning chef Sean Brock at McCrady's. That's where he started to kind of dabble with the pig, so to speak. It was there in Charleston that Nathan went whole hog. He learned about heritage hogs from the chef. He started to have more respect for the art and the handcraft of charcuterie. He helped open Chef Brock's restaurant, Husk. And then came back to New Orleans. Kind of fell in under the tutelage of Chef Donald Link, who has couchons. And that's where he fine-tuned his sausage and bacon-making skills.
Sounds pretty good.
It does. So now Nathan is the butcher over at Restaurant Revolution, you and Rick's place there in New Orleans. And he spends his days kind of hoisting those 300 pounds of pork and masterfully creating delicacies such as the cured salamis and the hams and the tasso and the andouille and the pâtés and the hogshead cheese. Nathan, welcome to Stirring It Up. So great to have you with us in the studio.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
And I know that John and Rick are delighted, as we all are, to have you as part of the Restaurant Revolution team. Awesome to kind of snatch you away. And
yeah, it's crazy. You know, you mentioned traveled all over, but there's no place like South Louisiana.
You're right about that.
Yeah, something about it that just draws you back to it.
So tell us, you mentioned learning to cook with your father and picking vegetables with your grandfather. Tell us about some of those early food moments that kind of shaped that desire to become a chef.
Something that people here just grew up doing, you know. It's part of life, you know. You hear people in the South, the males cook. You know, yeah. My mom doesn't have a clue how to cook, and she would back that up, you know. So it's with my, you know, daddy that I learned to cook. I just remember, you know, helping my grandpa grow his vegetables and pick his vegetables and going to the markets and selling them, and never occurred to me throughout high school that I want to be a chef.
Mm-hmm.
Never.
It was just something you did.
Now, did your family, I mean, I grew up in a family that did a lot of boucheries. We raised pigs. We always had about five or six big white chesters, you know, and those hogs in the pen. We always were feeding corn at certain times a year.
I think the first boucherie that I did personally was, that I truly remember, it's probably when I was about 21, 22, I decided, you know what, just going to go again, like you mentioned, hog wild, and picked up a 300-pound hog from the stockyard, shot it myself, cleaned it, you know, broke it all down, and it was about a two-day party, you know. We sat out there and cases of beers and scraped the hog and, you know, did the old traditional way. But I never remember my grandpa or any of them actually doing that. He always raised hogs. One of them was the Red Wattle, which is a native hog to East Texas through Louisiana. It was brought in by the French that I remember him raising as a young kid, but never had a chance to actually see him slaughter anything but chickens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so at some point in life, you know, I decided that I wanted to be a chef, you know, and didn't think I would really want to be a butcher or a charcuterie. And I hit Europe, got into Europe, and I used to go for morning runs. I was in Italy for the most part. And I'd go by, and you smell the bakery and all that. And at every corner had their own butcher, own meat market.
Mm.
And it came to a point where I'd go out on runs, and I would bring money with me so I could just eat, you know. So,
good thing you were on a run.
Yeah, good thing I was running, you know.
What part of Italy was
that? I started in the northern part of Italy, in Lombardia region, worked my way down to the southern end of Italy, just hanging out on a work-study scholarship that I won. And it was then that it dawned on me that I've always heard stories of people, you know, I'm sure you remember all these meat markets that were on the corners, and all of a sudden the bigger people started coming in, you know, your Winn-Dixies and Rouse's, and it knocked all those people out. So I never had a chance to experience that until I went to Italy, and then it was like, wow, this is what everybody grew up back in the day doing. You know, this is what I have to do. And that's when I kind of fell in love with it.
From there, you jumped into one of the most famous kitchens of America. I mean, to walk into Commander's Palace Kitchen. Who's the chef there then?
It was Torrey.
Torrey McPhee, yeah. And he's still there.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about those first days at Commander's. What was your great impression of the place? What was it like working for the Brennan family? What was that kitchen like?
Wow, you know, oddly enough, it was Chris Lusk, who's the, you know, chef at Revolution, who actually hired me there. And it was just eye-opening because I'd never worked in a restaurant, never seen it. And it was just unbelievable how it was just controlled chaos. People running around, people yelling, and it was adrenaline rush.
Yeah.
I sat there, and I used to peel potatoes, peel shrimp, and I used to time myself and how fast I could peel a case of potatoes or how fast I can peel 5 pounds of shrimp just to get better, just to improve. And then after doing prep for a couple of weeks, I went on to the pastry kitchen for, I guess it was about a year. And then that's when another thing just kind of hit out. It's like pastries are another thing that's separate from cooking because it's time. You have to have patience. You have to...
It's a science.
Yeah, exactly. So I kind of fell in love with doing pastries and started thinking about, well, maybe I want to be a pastry chef. Hung out a couple of places as pastries, and then I kind of moved on up around my way through the kitchen. And I guess it was after... I guess after Hurricane Katrina that I became the butcher over there and slash sous chef and just kind of worked my way up in there. And after I, you know, thought I learned all that I can, I moved on and left Louisiana again and went over to Charleston.
And tell us about Charleston, because it seems like that experience truly kind of defined, and we keep saying it, but you really went hog wild for pork at that time. You perfected that art.
You know, I worked for Sean Brock, who... Oddly enough, I met New Orleans at Commander's. We traded business cards, and I guess 3 weeks later, I was on my way to Charleston and did a 3-day stage at McCready's and hung out with Sean, followed him for 3 days. I mean, one of the most passionate guys I've ever met about cooking and gardening, and he did it all. He had everything. He grew his own hogs. He grew his own vegetables. Everybody would go out in the morning, pick their own vegetables, come back to McCready's and cook them. Just a whole new experience. And then I did that for about 2 weeks, and then finally he offered me a position there because he was opening up, which is probably 3 years now, 2 years, Husk Restaurant, which again was awarded James Beard and Bon Appetit Best Restaurant and this and that. And that's when everything just started to click, that I just started getting it for once.
Well, what about the deal with the heritage hogs? Because I hear that a lot, and it sounds like that's where you were kind of introduced to the whole concept. And are they that much better?
Oh, absolutely. I was kind of lost in it too. You know, I thought Rouse's had the best pork.
Yeah.
You know, it's commodity now to me that it's pork. Mm-hmm. It's not the best. It's full of, you know, hormones and this and that. And so I started hanging out with him, and we would go down to Ossabaw Island in Georgia, and it's where the Ossabaw hog came from the Spaniards, which is a cross between the Iberica and I can't think of the other hog, but it's this beautiful, beautiful hog. Grows probably about 200-300 pounds, which is, I think it was brought into the early 1700s by the Spaniards explorers who just let them go on the land, and the other explorers would come by and eat them. And he started eating this hog, and it was just, the taste of it was so much different than what I was used to eating from the Dorax or the Berkshires. And then they brought another one. It was called a Mangalista, which is an English hog, which was just bred for the lard at one time.
Oh, wow.
Once the lard population started to die out because people were eating more healthy, they were left with all these hogs. And the taste of the Mangalista, it's the weirdest tasting but purest tasting of pork. It almost tastes like beef. You have this beautiful, I'm not lying, it's probably a 2-inch fat cap along that pork chop. And you just put that in a cast iron pan, you just sear that, and it gets real crispy, flip it over. It's the most wonderful tasting hog I've ever had.
So of the heirloom breeds like that, what is probably the finest tasting pork? Because I know you've been to a lot of the competitions, you've seen all the breeds. butchered and cooked. If you had to raise two hogs, what would they be?
Definitely, since I'm a huge bacon fan, it would have to be a red wattle. Red wattles grew up to 600 to 800 pounds.
Wow.
And strictly used for bacon only. And then the Megalista would probably go third, but the Osterball is by far one of the best things to use for curing, making sausages.
Where did he buy his hogs from? I mean, where did Sean...
He got the bloodlines from Osterball Island, and he brought them back to the plantation that one of the owners had on an island called Watama Island, which was another cool little place, a story in itself, that is the only tea plantation in America that still produces tea today.
Oh, wow.
Out in Watama Island, South Carolina. So you had them out there, and we would go there and we would raise them, and obviously, you know, we couldn't slaughter them ourselves because of USDA, but we'll raise them, mm-hmm. feed them, play with them, whatever we want with them, and brought them to the main butcher, and I'd watch them butcher it, and then I'd break them down from there.
Then you came back to New Orleans, and then you worked for the master there, a good friend of all of ours, and that's Chef Donald Link, who opened a restaurant named after the hog,
yeah.
Cochon. And I tell you what, I have a lot of respect for Donald because he actually jumped out into an arena that committed it all to one thing on the table, and that was pork. Even though there's other, obviously a few other things on the menu, it is dedicated to pork. He came right out and slammed it on the sign, Cochon. How was that experience compared to, say, Sean Brock? What was the learning curve to each one?
The learning curve was, you know, what Sean learned about Southern cooking, the whole term of the meaning of Southern cooking. Then, you know, I started working with Dono, and in my mind, he was the only person in Louisiana that was doing true Louisiana Cajun Creole cooking by taking whole hogs and breaking them down, getting the pork chops out of them, getting the butts out of them, curing the baking, smoking it, making andouille, making head cheese.
Now, was he raising his own pigs, or was he buying them?
He was buying them, but within about a year ago, he started raising his own pigs out in Alabama, out right outside of Birmingham, mm-hmm. which was a cross between a Dorac and a, I can't think of the other hog, they call it a blue butt hog. Mm-hmm. It was two different crosses. I want to say it was a Berkshire that produced this another wonderful hog that now supplies Cochon New Orleans as well as the butcher shop as well as Cochon Lafayette as well.
Now, let's talk. We talked charcuterie, and now I think our listeners have established that there's these beautiful heritage breeds that now the cooks and the chefs are looking at in a different way. Like I said, my grandfather had two hogs, and both of those were great hogs. He raised them up to 700 pounds. I remember we used to use a winch truck to lift the hogs up after we had to butcher them.
Yeah.
And there was about 10 families, blacks and whites alike, who came together in the community to butcher these two or three hogs at a time. And the meat was all divided up, and we made sausages and andouille. We smoked. We made head cheese. We made hams. We made boudins. The lard cans were absolutely filled with 5 gallons of this beautiful lard. We made crackling. And it was just a way of life. But now we've moved it into the restaurants, and now you are head of butchery at our restaurant at Revolution in New Orleans. Now, tell us that move. Now, you were working in these restaurants. Now you're heading your own department at what is now one of the top restaurants in the city in New Orleans. What is your day like, and how do you begin? How do you sit and look at the meat daily and say, okay, this is my need today? Where does that begin?
Again, it's kind of controlled chaos sometimes. Even for me, as being by myself, just butchering. The usual day, you know, I can get 300 pounds of pork cleaned up, done, you know, make 40 pounds of andouille, you know, 15 pounds of head cheese or 10 pounds of boudin. So the usual day, it's up in the air. It just depends on the needs of what's going on. And what's so hard, I got to balance between, you know, what I look at in three different positions. You know, I got to take care of all the fish. We get all our fish come in whole, so I have to break down all that fish.
Now, that's kind of odd for a restaurant that brings in all the fish whole, as we do. Not many restaurants still do that. But that's where our great fish stocks and all of that come from.
Absolutely.
All of our gumbos and our seafood gumbo is made with the bones of real fish. I mean, that's very odd. But again, that's the butcher department.
Right. You know, and then three is butchering poultry, butchering rabbits or venison or any other animal.
I had no idea y'all were butchering all
We butcher everything whole. Yeah. We bring in everything whole, yeah.
I never thought of butchering a fish, but it is.
Yeah.
But it is.
Yeah.
I mean, when you fillet it or...
Right. And then third, I got to balance out charcuterie. Which, you know, I make, again, the head cheese, the andouille, the smoked sausage, the tasso, boudin, if I didn't say that. Sometimes I make the blood boudin. Sometimes I throw in something random that comes into the door, like Nutra or something, you know.
Wildlife and Fisheries brought me some Nutra the other day, and we turned it into a great sausage. How's that coming, by the way?
Good. I'm hopefully better pull it next week sometime to try the first of it. So.
Well, that was going to be my question. You know, you use the term pig magic, and I was just wondering how much freedom do you have to kind of experiment? I mean, obviously the Nutria sausage was one of those.
Well, I challenged him that day.
Yeah. My little hamsters upstairs were running hard on this one, but luckily I'd had the experience and I'd adapted recipes. That I had a recipe when I was out in Europe for squirrel sausage, and I just kind of took that idea and adjusted a couple of things, and that's the whole beauty about it, and the patience that you have to do this. It might be the nastiest thing we ever had.
Yeah, you know, but there's only one way to find out, right?
You know, so I take my little notes, and we'll try it next week, and we'll see what happens.
And it's going to be magnificent, because when you look at just the area of the sausage styles that you make in the restaurant at Revolution Flower Charcuterie Boards, how many do you make at any given time? How many is hanging at any given time?
Well, right now, counting, I mean, you know, charcuterie, again, it's such a wide range that, I mean, I probably have maybe 20 things. You know, I have venison brassola. I have regular brassola that comes off of beef. I have pepperoni. I have sopressata. We've got lard en cuirin. I have different cacciatora. I have a Russian Moscow salami. I have...
And, of course, these beautiful smoked meats that's going all the time in our smoker.
Yeah, right? Chorizo. You know, I have numerous of things going on. All the
I love
bacon.
That.
Well, y'all, we're talking about charcuterie today, and we're talking about the wonderful art of taking meats from the boucherie, which is the slaughtering of pigs, any type of beef, of veal, and then moving them from the primal cuts that you go into the store and you buy your pork chops or your roast or anything like that, and moving that into the lesser used cuts that move their way into the charcuterie programs, the sausages and the tureens and the pâtés and the galantines and all of that. And, of course, we have a great guest who's chatting all about that today. So we're going to be back in just a little bit. We're going to continue to talk about some of these. And we're going to cook a little bit. We're going to talk about books. And we're also going to hear what's going on our Facebook page.
Every day. Every day.
Frederick Delius was born in England, but his music touches on a variety of locales. In one intriguing opera, he takes a traditional story of star-crossed lovers, often set in Italy, and transplants it to a quiet hamlet in Switzerland. I'm Lisa Simeone. Join me for A Village Romeo and Juliet by Delius, next time on World of Opera.
Monday night at 7 on KRVS.
Happening musically in Dakar, Joburg, Kinshasa, Port Spain, Havana, Accra, Dar es Salaam, Cairo, Paris, New York. Well, tune in this week and every week to find out on Afropop Worldwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday night at 8 on KRVS.
This is Emily with Rock Japan inviting you to join me late night Fridays at 3 a.m. and Mondays at 11 p.m. here on KRVS 88.7 FM. We'll explore the new, old, and experimental music of the island nation of Japan and how they rock the world from dusk till the rising sun.
All right. everybody. Welcome back to the kitchen table. Today we're talking about pig magic. I guess that's what we're talking about. Anyway, y'all, welcome back. So, Michelle, we've been having a great conversation here with the butcher.
Yes, we have.
At Revolution Restaurant.
It's an honor to be here.
Now, you and I are going to raise a hog, okay? Let me tell you what
we're all right. I like the way this is going to sound.
Michelle, hold on a
minute. When did this come up? Where are we going to put a hog?
Do you want to be a part of this thing or not?
Well, yeah. I just want to make sure it's not going to be in my backyard.
Uh-oh. It's not going to be in your backyard. It's going to be in my backyard.
That'll be good.
Slama. You see how fast she says, yes, but on condition. You see, Nathan and I, we didn't throw conditions. I was going to raise a hog.
All that living and feeding, and that's minuscule.
Remember we did the boucherie at White Oak? You were there with my film crew, and we brought our hog in. We shot the hog. We cleaned it. We scraped it. We did everything the way we used to do. Remember that?
Yes, I did. And I remember when the unfortunate happened that, you know, you do have to harvest, and we both felt really bad, so somebody else needs to harvest
to kill a hog.
Yes.
To harvest, you're using the term harvest.
Yes,
and,
I'm trying
rather
to
than saying, okay. Right, but anyway, so you and I are going to raise a hog. We're going to commit it today, so we're going to go out and we're going to search out the hog that we want that's going to give us the meat for this event that we're going to do at Revolution. In the spring, we're going to do our annual boucherie. The boucherie is going to be a dinner that comes from our hog that we raise. What hog are we going to buy for that boucherie? Now, remember, you have to make sausages, you have to make terrines, you have to make galantines. I mean, you got the whole thing coming your way here. Plus, we got to secure the primal cuts for the dinner itself. We got to make some andouille fire gumbos.
Absolutely.
What hog are we
getting? You doing one hog?
We're going to get a couple of hogs, but we searched out some land yesterday. I went to White Oak. I went over to Sister's, and Sister Dulce is next door to White Oak Plantation,
okay.
And I walked the property with her. We had coffee together talking about some of the things she wanted to grow over there. She put her chicken pens in.
She has.
Well, I said a chicken mansion. The chickens are living in the Ritz-Carlton, you know.
The chicken condo.
But anyway, so we're going to do two pigs. What pigs are we getting? Now, take your time before you answer that, because these are the pigs that we're going to call ours. Which ones are we choosing?
Ah, man, you know, that's a tough question. If we got so much stuff coming off of that. So I say definitely, since it's part of the South and part of Louisiana and such a beautiful hog, we got to go with the red wattle, the French hog, you know, 600-800 pounds. We get that nice bacon off of there. Next would be another big hog, would be a mangalista.
I was thinking about that Spanish hog myself, you know. I was thinking about the...
The Otsubal, you know, your problem is it don't get as big as your normal hog.
I think we're all going to go with the red wattle. But I think we ought to bring in one of the Spanish, you know.
Okay. If we really want to do it, let's cross them ourselves.
Oh, good God.
Well, that's another whole story.
Now we're getting into genetics. I think we need to start.
Well, yeah, we're going to start. We cross them out. So you want to cross the red wattle with the Spanish. Now, what is the Spanish one?
The Otsubal.
Spell that for us.
Otsubaw.
The Otsubaw, that's for all of our listeners out there who think we might be starting with an I.
Otsubaw Island.
That's in the Carolinas.
Actually, it's Georgia. Otsubaw Island, Georgia. It's a barrier reef.
Okay, y'all,
island.
So you heard it here first. So we're going to get one red wattle. Do you have our source to get the pigs?
I can look it up.
Okay, so today he's going to go home and look up our two pigs, and we're going to bring them in. I got my carpenter going to go over to build my pig. We're going to do a little show about building your pig pen. You know,
that's good. Mm-hmm.
We're off and running, so that's what we're going to do, y'all.
We'll start.
And I think you probably want to go to our Facebook page. And Michelle, you might want to talk about our Facebook page, because Slama, they want to sign up. We're only taking 50 people for this dinner.
For the dinner, yeah.
So they have to sign up now. And I'm going to go ahead, we'll commit the price of $250 a head.
Nice.
Because, I mean, that's the whole deal, right?
Yeah.
That includes a glass of wine or two, you know, a little libation.
As long as libations include, so you got swine, wine, and dine.
That's the name of our deal. Swine, wine, and dine.
I like it.
Swine, wine, and dine. So you got to monitor every week. We can only take 50 people, and this is going to be January or 1st of February.
The 1st of February.
Well, it's got to be after February.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was swine, wine, and dine.
Swine, wine, and dine.
We're going to commit to the date next week. We're going to get on the calendar. So get with the team over there and find out what's our date. I'd say it's got to be on a Thursday night.
Yeah, I think a Thursday night would be good, too.
Thursday night will be perfect. What do you think?
Mm-hmm.
Thursday night will be perfect. 50 people, first come, first serve. Now you got to give us your deposit, 50%
deposit. That's right, because we got to buy the pig.
Yeah, we got to buy the pig and
how
feed
it. How long did it take to fatten up?
Well, we're going to be working on that pig between now. I mean, we got to get one pretty fully grown now because, you know.
We can feed it Krispy Kremes or, you know, get it real fat real quick.
So anyway, yeah, we need a 50% deposit, y'all, from your ticket because then we got to go out and build a pig pen and all that. But don't worry about that. That's our
That's
deal.
That's right. So we got that.
The first 50 people, and you know who's the first one to throw his dollar in, huh?
Yeah.
David Hubble.
David Hubble.
I don't know for sure, but I think David Hubble, and I met David Hubble's family at the restaurant this week. They came in, the Hubbles from Bioshare. Yep, came in to talk about David. Anyway, what about our Facebook page, Michelle?
Facebook.com/stirringitupradio.
This is a commitment to the first annual Swine, Wine, and Dine. And we're going to call it, it's going to be our Swine, Wine, and Dine Eat Contest.
Eat contest.
Come to Revolution Eat contest. Okay, that's it, y'all. So $250. We're going to give you the date on our website.
The byline. Come make a pig of yourself.
Yeah, come make a pig of yourself. That's exactly right. Okay, so Michelle, talking about books. I mean, I know you have some great books up because as we do every week, y'all, we always give you our little secrets as to the information source to everything on the topic. And, of course, it comes out of our library. You go in our library, and every one of our books are cataloged, and you know exactly what you're going to get. And I have a couple of them here from Professional Charcuterie to the American Charcuterie, Pig to Tail Recipes. What did you choose from the library?
Oh, my gosh. I'm salivating over here just looking at the pictures. This is a great book published in 1984, Pâtés and Terrines.
That's a great one.
One of my favorites.
Pâtés and Terrines, an unparalleled presentation of one of the most versatile of the culinary arts. It was written by a couple of authors, Friedrich Ehlert, Edward Long, Michael Raphael, and Frank Wessel. There's a lot of historical information in here, kind of a review of pâtés and terrines. Has a terrific explanation of the art of charcuterie. Many, many, many recipes from the simple pâtés, as we were kind of mentioned earlier, that require, you know, limited skill. That's the learner section. That's me. To very elaborate masterpieces, but they include step-by-step photos of putting these terrines together.
That's what makes that book really good. Yeah. Even the great charcuterie makers use that book.
I look at the pictures from time to time just to make sure I'm right.
Yeah, I mean, it's fabulous. They have sections on pastries when we're talking about the terrines. They have a section on forcemeats, which we haven't talked a whole lot about today. Aspic jellies, galantines. I love that there's a chapter called The Outsiders Among Pâtés. And also there's a chapter, Pâtés Around the World. You just got to love chapter headings like that, right?
No, it's really good.
It's a wonderful edition. I'm actually going through right now, and I'm marking the photos of things that I'd like for Nathan to try, and then he can bring samples and, you know, just perfecting those skills even further.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I'm just thinking here.
Of course, absolutely. That's a great book.
Look at these pictures. Yeah. Oh my gosh, doesn't that look good?
That's a whole foot of
that's the whole foot of the
pâté
pig.
On the stuffed pig's feet. Pâté on the hoof.
Yeah. And Michelle, also, I think we ought to add to that the Professional Charcuterie series. If you're going to dabble in it, Pâtés and Terrines, absolutely fantastic book. It's just about everything you need. But if you're going to get really into it and want to get serious about it, then you should have the Professional Charcuterie, that's C-H-A-R, which means flesh, and C-U-T-E-R-I-E, to cook and make. So charcuterie, the Professional Charcuterie series, which is Jean-François Desportes and Jean-Pierre Audeau and Marcel Cotenceau, so you can imagine what this book is all about. But it is step-by-step as well for pâtés, terrines, ballantines made with poultry, veal, pork liver, andouilles, andouillettes, foie gras. Everything's in the book. It's even got a picture of Carl Fatt here for people who didn't know what I was talking about when I was talking about the lace. See it right up there at the top. Yeah. Anyway, y'all, both of those in the charcuterie series, the Professional Charcuterie series, is volume 1 and 2. And I guarantee you, if you go to Amazon or those, you can get these books for a fairly inexpensive price. And, of course, one of our all-time favorite books, and I know everybody has it already if you're involved in this, is right here.
John gets excited over charcuterie.
Brian Polson. is just a really unbelievable charcuterie maker. And, of course, Michael Ruhlman over at Schoolcraft College in Detroit, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And they wrote the book on charcuterie, The Craft of Salting, Smoking, and Curing Meats. And, again, the name of the book is simply Charcuterie, C-H-A-R-C-U-T-E-R-I-E. All three of these will be on the website, and I think you can be the greatest expert on the subject if you put these and you put them to use, right?
That's right.
Thanks, sir.
So what is your favorite of all? If you had to stop today and say, I'm only going to do one pate, and I'm only going to do one otterine, and I'm only going to do one sausage, and it's the one I'm going to live with.
To me, the great thing about traveling in South Louisiana, stopping at a gas station and and grabbing a link of Buddha, by far. But the second would probably be foie gras terrines, foie gras mousse.
Okay, now you're talking.
Absolutely. I'm going to give you a recipe because Michelle requested the baked duck liver pate.
Mm-hmm. Now, I adapted it. I've used chicken liver, because I didn't have duck liver.
Well, I've also adapted chicken as well. So you're going to use 2 pounds of duck liver. I'm going to give you this recipe because this should definitely be a part of our charcuterie board, no doubt about it.
All right.
2 pounds of chicken livers, or duck livers if you're cooking a lot of duck. 8 strips of good apple wood smoked bacon, just to put that little fruitiness in it and that wonderful apple wood smoke. Salt, pepper to taste, granulated garlic. 2 bay leaves are going to go into it. 6 to 8 cloves of thinly sliced garlic. You're going to have 8 ounces of cream cheese softened. And then you're going to have 1/4 pound of unsalted butter. You see where we're going? You got liver, you got butter, you got cream cheese, you got garlic. You with me? And then, of course, that 1/2 cup of fine cognac.
Yes.
Now, this is what you're going to do. You're going to heat your oven to 375 degrees, and you're going to line a nice casserole dish with bacon. You're going to put that bacon down on the bottom of the pan. Then on top of that bacon, and if you need more than 8 strips, go ahead and put 12.
It doesn't matter.
You're going to add on top of those layers of bacon across the bottom of the pan, you're going to go ahead and put your 2 pounds of chicken livers or duck livers in that. Now, of course, you want to separate the livers, and you want to take that sinew. You know, if there's any of the bile duct that's still on that little green bile duct, you want to take that off. Just scrape that off of there. And it's no big deal. There's some little vein structure that kind of holds the livers together. Just take your paring knife and cut that out.
Right.
You just want the lobes, in other words. You're going to lay those livers in, then you're going to season those livers with salt, pepper, and granulated garlic. Not garlic powder, y'all. Nice dehydrated, grained garlic. You're going to put that in there. Then you're going to tuck the bay leaves and the sliced garlic cloves all in between the lobes of liver on top of the bacon. Then you're going to cover it, and you're going to bake it for about 45 minutes or so to an hour, because remember, the bacon has to cook as well, until the center temperature. I always keep a digital thermometer right in the middle of it. When I get it to 165 or 70, I'll take it out. I'm done. I don't want to get the livers so brown you can't do anything with them. I'm just trying to get the bacon and everything cooked. I'm going to remove them from the oven, and I'm going to cool all of that slightly. It's going to take about an hour. I normally let them cool for about 2 hours. And then I pour those contents onto a cookie sheet just to kind of cool them a little faster. I discard the bay leaves, and then I pour everything else, all the juices, the garlic, the livers, everything, into a food processor. I add the cream cheese that's been softened. I add that 1/4 pound of butter, and I add the cognac. I puree it on high speed until it is very, very, very smooth and creamy. I just let it go. And you can imagine the cream cheese and the bacon and the garlic and the butter, all of that's coming together. And, of course, the livers are just pureeing and smoothing out into the blade of that food processor. Then adjust the seasonings if necessary. A little salt and extra pepper goes into it at that point. Then I pour this liquidy puree down into these little decorative molds. Normally no more than 4 ounces or 5 ounces, because you want to eat it all. And, you know, I put it in the refrigerator and I chill it overnight, a minimum of 6 to 8 hours, because then everything's going to set. Everything's going to gel beautifully in that. And I'll serve it with warm French bread croutons. The thing about this is the normal bitterness that you would think of in a liver pate is now gone because the cream cheese, the cognac, the butter has smoothed and balanced those flavors just beautifully in there. The garlic, the salt, pepper, granulated garlic, and the smoky bacon has added its own dimension of flavor. And it is absolutely magnificent. And I even thought when we opened Revolution that one of the muses would be, as a house special, it would be our duck or goose or chicken liver pate, because it makes use of it.
Right.
And just to put a little spoon of it, it is really the best liver pate ever made, I think, is this particular one.
Definitely you have to try it.
It's in the cookbook. So, y'all, we want to remind you about the big challenge that we have coming up here. Swine, wine, and dine. We got to go buy two pigs, y'all, so we have to run.
Right.
Hey, 2 weeks to Christmas, and if I'm not on your list, well...
He's registered at Lucullus.
I'm registered at Lucullus in New Orleans. Hey, y'all, if I don't see you, Merry Christmas.
Some of the world's oldest festivals were held around the middle of winter. The ancient Celts thought the midwinter sun stood still for 12 days. Our music on the Thistle and Shamrock never does, and this week it'll lighten and brighten the shortest days of the year. Join me.
Coming up Sunday evening at 6, here on KRVS.